ABC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott-Jones, Dennis Norden, Dillis Powell, and Frank Miller. And here's round one to test their respective vocabularies. Two marks, if you can tell me the meaning of these words. We begin with Anne Scott-Jones. Anne, what does frangipane or frangipani mean?
Well, it's a plant.
Yes?
It's a tree which is covered with glorious and brilliant blossoms.
Yes.
And you see it in, the Middle East, see it in India, see it in the Caribbean, etc.
What do you make from it?
What do you make from it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, flowery wreaths.
You could, I suppose.
Cut flower arrangements. Very good for flower arrangements, in black vases.
I'm bound to give you your two marks. It wasn't all the answer I wanted, but you were accurate. It's the red jasmine tree, but it's normally used of the perfume which it's prepared from, or which imitates the smell of the red jasmine flower. And it comes from a chap who was called Monsieur Frangipani. This seems rather odd. Two. Frank Miller, what's the meaning of disembogue? Dis-M and then B-O-G-U-E. Disembogue.
It's the opposite of embogue.
Yes.
Well, embus is to get in a bus. It means, will you kindly leave the lavatory?
you're not all that far wrong. If you stick to sort of watery metaphors, you might get there.
Ah, it's a movement of water.
Yes.
To disembogue.
Yes.
They waters are disemboguing.
That's it. Have a shot at what you think they might be doing. Absolutely right.
I would have thought they're leaping over a sandbar.
Yes, they might be doing that. It means to pour forth at the mouth of a river or to flow into something, for instance, into the sea, or it can mean, figuratively, to pour forth like a crowd or a speech. Now, dear Lisbeth, what is a lapicide? L-A-P-I-C-I-D-E. Lapicide.
Lapis. A stone.
Yes.
And a side is a sort of killer or chopper.
Yes.
So this a stone chopper. Would that be you?
Near enough.
Not very near.
One who cuts stones, or could be one who cuts an inscription on a stone. Same again. Latin, lapis stone, caedere to cut or kill. Two marks. Dennis Norden, what is or was a bum bailiff?
Well, it was the chap who came round when you were evicted. Well, there was a famous comedy where there was, which Sidney Howard appeared in which he said, "Here I am and here I stay until I get what I came for." Do you remember that?
Yes.
Very early comedy, all about one. Why it's called I think it's called a bum bailiff because it was for people who got a little behind with their rent. That's jovial, isn't it?
That's very good. I give you one and a half. It isn't quite right, but you've got the bailiff bit right. It's a bailiff of the meanest kind, one that is employed in arrests, according to Dr. Johnson, and because he was called bum bailiff, because to make his arrest, he had to tap you on the back, and that's why it was bum bailiff. One and a half. Well, before we begin the next round, I'm going to read out a quotation for each team to write down, and I hope the two women members will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where they come from. Anne Scott-James and Dennis, yours is only connect. Only connect. And Dennis Powell and Frank Miller, yours is the son and heir of a mongrel bitch. And then in the last round, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. And now, round of origins and derivations, what I want is two things. First of all, the present meaning of this particular set of words or expressions, but also how they came to have that meaning, how the expression originated. Two marks for correct answers. Anne Scott-James, mind your P's and Q's.
It means now be very meticulous and careful and don't tread on people's toes or make mistakes or generally muck things up.
Yes.
Now, it must come from some language, mustn't it?
Yes.
What language is important to get your P's and Q's right? Oh, you think
any
printing,
language,
do you?
I should think, yeah.
Is it anything to do with type setting?
If you want a pint and you ask for a quint,
yes,
you wouldn't get what you want.
So, practically any language.
That's good enough. If you stick to your pub and you're there. Oh, well, what, next measure up from a pint.
A quart.
A quart.
I thought it was printing.
It is as well. Yeah. You'll get to that. The two most likely explanations are that it was a warning to either to children learning the alphabet or to printers, apprentices who were sorting out type, to be pretty careful to distinguish between the letters which had long tails, which were P's and Q's. But also in old time pubs, in the accounts scored up in chalk, a quart was a Q and a pint was just a P, and therefore the customer had to watch pretty carefully and see he wasn't being cheated. Mm. 2 marks. Frank Muir, Three Sheets in the Wind.
Well, it means a little bit spiffled. It means drunk.
Yes, and how does it come to have that meaning?
Nautical. Sheets are the ropes that tie... that go from a sail to the man's hand who's handling the sail. Three Sheets in the Wind means that instead of being in his hand, they're in the wind.
Yes. What happens then to the ship or boat?
Not a good thing, Jim. Not a good thing at all. No, they would yaw.
Yes,
they would yaw.
That's what I wanted. 2 marks. It
and
means
what's yours, and you say mine's a pint. Mine's a pint of course.
Frank's quite right. It means very drunk, just about as drunk as you can be. And if you let go on a ship which has three sails, the three sheets, then the ship itself starts yawing or behaving in a very drunken manner, and you can't control it at all. So three sheets in the wind. Dennis Powell, to win hands down.
Win hands down means to win very easily.
And why?
Because your opponent isn't much good.
But what are you doing with your hands?
You're riding a horse, and you're so good that you aren't sort of rushing forward, but then you've got your hands on his neck.
Yeah. Means to win without the slightest difficulty. If a jockey wins with his hands down, it shows he hasn't had to bother himself much. The race was something of a walkover, and Dennis is quite right there. Dennis Norton, to eat humble pie.
Today it means to having to apologize abjectly.
Yes.
For something that you've been rather arrogant about. Now I do know where this comes from. Yes, humble was the offal that used to be served at sort of medieval feasts only to the oiks at one end of the table while all the nobility were eating sort of scampi and stuff at the other end. So therefore, if you ate the humble or offal, you were lowly and abject.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Dennis. 2 marks. The lord and his household, after you'd killed a deer, they'd dine on the proper venison, but as Dennis says, the hunt followers and servants had things like the heart and liver and entrails and made into a great pie called Humble's Pie. 2 marks. There are certain English words that are spelt alike but have sharply differing meanings, and they don't always, of course, come from the same grammatical root. For 2 marks, can you give me 3 different meanings for each of the following words, beginning with Anne Scott James and gammon?
I would start with, it means a nice bit of bacon.
Yes, that's a good start.
Which you can either have with parsley sauce or with a sherry sauce or with new potatoes or broad beans, don't you think?
Well, there's 3 different types of gammon.
Yes, 3 different types of gammon. Well, it means nonsense.
Yes,
gammon,
that's true.
As in gammon and spinach.
That's 2 out of 3. Yeah, it's a game.
Backgammon. But that's two
yes, that's
one
right.
word, isn't it?
Yep. Now, I think I helped a little too much then. 1 and a half, anyway.
You did?
It is the bottom piece of a flitch of bacon, including, I think, the hind leg. It's a kind of victory at backgammon in which the winner gets double stakes and a verb of the same kind. It also, as Anne quite rightly says, means humbug or nonsense, and to talk in that way. And finally, a nautical one, which Frank probably knows, to lash a ship's bowsprit to the stern and the lashing itself. Frank, now, chase, just C-H-A-S-E, chase.
No problem. Chase means to dash smartly after.
Yes.
The verb. or it means an area in which things four-legged append in order that people may dash after them.
Yes, well,
as in Cheviot Chase and so forth. It means there's a printing thing.
Yes, there is. 2 marks splendidly. I think nothing you've left out, except it is also part of a gun enclosing the bore or a groove cut in a wall to take something which looks like a gun barrel, a pipe, for instance. And it is also the result of a stroke in real tennis as opposed to lawn tennis. 2 marks it is. Well, now, to Lispel, your word is maroon. M-A-R-O-O-N. Maroon.
Well, it's a colour.
Yes.
It's also a form of warning. You let off a maroon to say there's a disaster impending.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Maroon.
And one off.
And to be isolated.
Yes, I'll do. 2 marks it is. Maroon is brownish-crimson colour, claret-coloured. It's a firework filled with gunpowder and making a very loud noise. It is to put somebody ashore and leave him on a desolate island or a coast as a punishment. It's also a Negro descended from fugitive slaves living in the mountains of Dutch Guiana and the West Indies, and it can be, as in French melon, the sweet chestnut. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, hobby.
Hobby? Well, it's first any kind of undertaking that you pursue simply for the pleasure of it.
Yes.
I don't know whether hobby horse is the same word.
Yes.
Or not. I tell you what else it is. You remember that marvellous Quatermass cereal?
Yes.
Well, the thing started in Hobby Lane, and they explained that hobby was the old name for hobgoblin, which was an evil spirit of some kind, and they said that hobby was an evil spirit.
I think, yes, I didn't know that, but I'll take that. 2 marks.
What do you like? I think that's right.
I think we should probably hear from people
if it isn't. Yeah. Anyway,
don't worry about it. The thing from which the hobby horse, the children's toy, was made, it was just a small or middle-sized horse, a kind of pony. It is also a kind of falcon, which was used to hunt very small birds like larks. And it was also an early type of velocipede, a forerunner to the bicycle. But you get your 2. Well, now we come to the last round. I go back to those quotations I gave the 2 teams earlier in the programme. 2 marks again. And Scott James, I'd like the origin of your quotation. Only connect.
I think it's Howards End.
By?
E.M. Foster.
Good enough. It's the motto or epigraph of E.M. Foster's novel Howards End, written, as far as I remember, around about 1912. Now, Lispel, I'd like the origin of your quotation. The son and heir of a mongrel bitch.
Mongrel bitch. Could it be Shakespeare?
Yes, it is Shakespeare. Have a shot at the play. Somebody, pretty...
Hamlet?
You're not very far wrong.
It's a tragedy.
It's a tragedy, yes.
I don't know. No, I really don't.
All right, 1 out of 2.
I really...
It's Shakespeare, King Lear, Act 2, Scene 2. It's part of a terrific tirade by Kent against Goneril's very prissy steward, Oswald. It's called all sorts of other things, too. 1 out of 2. Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their improbable explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round only, the marks will go to whichever unlikely story gets the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back we go to Dennis Norden and his quotation, Only Connect.
Somebody once told me about an English lit exam where... two students were asked the question, what is poetry? And one student wrote, poetry is the transcendental metaphor by which the human spirit imposes on the finite an oblique apprehension of the infinite. And the other student wrote, poetry is writing where all the lines begin with a capital letter. Now, that particular phenomenon, the way that the same thing can impinge on different minds in 2 completely different ways, that was brought home to me again recently when I was reading a book called Corporation Man by Anthony Jay. Now, what the book is about is how people in large corporations function. But what astonished me about it was that it's based on what Anthony Jay remembers about working inside the British Broadcasting Corporation. Because, you see, I was working there at exactly the same time. But do you know the only thing that I remember about being a corporation man? The office collections. Now, I don't know whether this ritual takes place in all large corporations, but at the BBC TV Centre, not once, but at least twice or three times every single day, there'd be a knock on your office door, and in would come this girl with a collecting box. Now, I'm not certain whether it was always the same girl, but it was always the same looking girl. Do you know what I mean? One of those neat, well-meaning kind of faces that always goes with fat legs. And she'd say, excuse me, I hope I'm not interrupting, but Penny Sanderson's having a baby. I say, well, if you need hot water, wouldn't the canteen... The following week, just as you're in the middle of an important telephone call, who puts her head round the door but Miss Fatlegs again? Would you like to see what we bought for Penny? Can you hold on a moment, New York? I have to look at a matinee jacket. Now, this ritual isn't limited just to fertility. The box comes round equally promptly for birthdays, engagements, weddings, silver weddings, and any form of minor surgical work. And the case that I'll never forget was when an accountancy clerk one day on the 12th floor, he went suddenly demented, climbed out the window and poised himself on the ledge. Well, you should have seen the excitement at the BBC. There were police there, and firemen, and a priest, and even the director of personnel himself, pleading, please don't jump. It'll ruin the holiday roster. But you know, the only thing that finally brought this accountancy bloke inside, just as he gathered himself to jump, the window next to his slid upwards and an arm poked out with a collecting box on the end, and this voice, before you go, Mr. Baxter, will you give a little towards Sandra Williamson? She's going in to have her nose done again. So now do you see what I mean by two minds recalling the same situation in two completely different ways? You see, to Mr. Anthony Jay's elegant mind, the corporation's activities broadened out into all different forms of territorial imperatives. But to my penny-pinching recollection, they just narrowed down to one imperative, that one of E.M. Forster's, only collect.
We'll have a whip round for Dennis at the end of the programme. And now we go on to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, the son and heir of a mongrel bitch.
My story is just a personal experience that happened to me when I was on holiday in Corsica. It's a sad story. Not funny, it concerns mongrel bitches, or at least, I don't know, it could have been a mongrel bitch or a mongrel dog. I won't stand out against mongrel bitches as against mongrel dog. The only thing, if it's mongrel bitch as against mongrel dog, is a bucket of cold water. This was... the dogs... But they were mongrel dogs on this stretch of sand where I went swimming. I went swimming alone. There were other people on the beach, but I wasn't with my wife. And the sun had come out very strongly, And I took my trousers... I had my swimming costume on underneath. And I took my trousers off and I folded them very carefully and put them on the beach. And I swam out to a rock, which is about 40 yards out. Most chaps' bathing costumes, ladies, I don't know whether you know, have a sort of drawstring. It's a sort of safety measure, which you knot tightly, you see, when you're swimming. So I undid the knot, you see, and lay back, much more comfortable. And then I thought I'd dive in. And I swam briskly for the shore, four strokes, fast crawl, 6 minutes rest, get the breath back. So, and I got out of the water. And then there were sort of two noises hit me. There was a rather elderly lady sort of screamed, and a rather young, brassy lady who looked as though she was married to a Nîmes garage proprietor and went in for wife swapping. She laughed. And then I realised that I hadn't got my shorts on. That in the diving off the rock, I'd lost my swimming shorts, and I was, in fact, naked. So once I went back into the water, took to the water, well, I was safe. I thought, well, look, I'll wait and just make a quick dash for my trousers. It was then I suddenly saw this pack of mongrel dogs descend on the beach. Now, that morning, I'd carried in the trouser pockets a camembert cheese. And they'd obviously smelt that because they fell upon my trousers and they rent them. They rent them in twain. And this pack of mongrels disappeared in two little packs, both massaging one leg of my trousers. A trowel each. They went out. And I stayed in the water from quarter past four until quarter to seven. And my skin was going all white and crinkly, like an apple pie just before it goes in the oven. And I was really feeling terribly cold, but the people left the beach. So I crept out. Nothing to hide my nakedness. Nothing. I stumbled across to a little sort of grassy bit, looking for something to hide myself, a sheet of Paris Match, anything. And there my luck was in. There was a sort of galvanized iron bucket, a sort of wide bucket, sort of bath affair, old and rusty. But I grabbed it up by the handles, clapped it over me salient features, and made my way up towards the village. And I had to slide along a wall to our house, and opposite the wall was the village inn. And there in front of it was all the village sitting watching a game of boule. You know, the funny game they play with heavy iron cannonballs. As I got to the end, the woman, a neighbour of ours, Madame Ferrari, suddenly looked at me, and I looked at her, and I said, bonsoir, bon appétit. And she said, monsieur, we know what you are thinking. And I said, what? She said, you are thinking there is a bottom in that bath. So I just want to say that if you go to seek the sunshine and the fresh air and the golden sands of Corsica, do avoid, as Shakespeare said, the sun and air of a mongrel beach.
Desperate places fact us stay in. Well, ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, Frank Muir, in fact, wins the contest of the two stories, but nevertheless the other team, Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, win the entire competition, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott-James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, who also compiled the questions. The programme was devised by Tony Schwan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.